Kevin Baugh, that is B-A-U-G-H, Kevin Baugh has his own country, the Republic of Molossia. And if you don't mind, he'd prefer that you call him His Excellency Kevin Baugh. This is actually from an article that was in the Chicago Tribune a couple of years ago. Kevin has an impressive khaki uniform with six big medals. He has a gold braid, epaulettes at the shoulders, and a blue, white, and green sash. Oh, and he also has a general's cap with a gold starburst over the bill. Never heard of the Republic of Molossia? Well, that's understandable because it consists of Baugh's three-bedroom house on 1.3 acres outside of Dayton, Nevada. And according to this article, he has a space program. It's a model rocket. He has a currency pegged to the value of chocolate chip cookie dough. That one works, I think. A railroad, a model railroad. He has a national sport, broomball, and in his landlocked desert region, he has a navy, an inflatable raft. The newspaper goes on to say, Baugh, a 45-year-old father of two, is a micro-nationalist. One of a wacky band of do-it-yourself nation builders who raise flags over their front yards and declare their property to be, as Baugh puts it, the kingdom of me. The kingdom of me. Now, for Baugh, it's partly a fun joke, but in some ways it isn't really, is it? Because I think we all build kingdoms of me. We all put flags in our front yard or wherever it is that we want to stake out and say, this is where I reign. This is where I determine what's going to happen. This is about my kingdom, my decisions, my ruling. But if we're going to walk the journey of discipleship, those will be challenged pretty early on and consistently. Today is the last Sunday of the season after Pentecost. That might mean nothing to you, but it does relate to the journey that we've walked in the church year. And we do follow the series of readings that really so many churches throughout the world follow, called the lectionary. We follow those readings and we follow the seasons of the year because they help us to walk the journey of Jesus with Him. Today we're at the end of a six-month sort of long trek through Jesus' teaching, through who He is, through His healings, and all of that work. And it culminates today. And then next Sunday, we start the journey all over again. It's New Year next week, by the way. It's the first Sunday of Advent. But we don't get there before we reach the climax of this journey. And we affirm ultimately Christ is the King over our lives and over all of creation. Whether we knew it or not, this is where we've been heading. This is the journey we've been on all summer and fall. We've been in a lengthy series in the Gospel of Luke. We've taken a detour here or there, but really the lectionary has invited us to follow Jesus in Luke as He teaches, as He heals, as He challenges the religious establishment of His time and begins to tell us about the kingdom of God and to show us the kingdom of God. And what He reveals has echoes from earlier times. This is why we have Old Testament readings as well as part of our Sunday worship. Because they are, you know, they sort of set the foundation, they set the stage that then we hear echoes of later. And if we stick with it and listen carefully, it starts to become clear that this is just really one story. It's not a multiple story, a group of stories. It's one story, and Jesus is the main character. Jesus is the fulfillment, the culmination of that one story. It's about Him, and it just makes sense in Him, the King. So to be here today at the culmination of one journey and really getting ready for the starting line of the next is to grasp the hinge that holds our lives together and around which they make sense. That there is a kingdom of God and the kingdom has a king and that He has claimed us in love and that we are under His reign. That's actually some good news, really good news, because of who he is and because of his character and the nature of his reign and how he rules. Because otherwise, we're just subjects, as many people have been subjects of any earthly kings down through the centuries. But Jesus, in his reign, reclaims the notion of rule and reign as it was meant to be, as God made it to be in creation itself. And that notion of ruling and reigning is good. It's very good. Now, I know we're not as familiar with kingdoms and monarchies as we used to be. I was thinking about in GAFCON, in our gathering, there was a time which the Archbishop of Canterbury sent along a video message. And he was explaining to the crowd gathered there why he couldn't be at GAFCON. It's because that week he had to do the baptism for Prince George, the future king. And people were kind, but I heard some groans go up. And they were mostly from people who at one point had been under the rule of the British Empire. And they could tell you all about what kings were. We have our own stories around that if we go back a couple hundred years. So we're not as familiar with it today, although many people are. There are 26 royal families serving today in the world. I did look that up, by the way, just so you know. And they have some relationship to a country whereby they are supreme. Either they're a total ruler or they serve as like a constitutional monarch, as a head of state. 26. But at one point there were hundreds and hundreds of kingdoms and rulers and of different kinds. And the New Testament itself was written at a time when there was a global system of government led by an emperor, a supreme emperor. So we hear the word king, or we hear the notion of kingdom and so on. Just remember, it had much more resonance at what time than it does for us. So I think we already bring hesitations to it, and even prejudices about it. Some people don't like using the word king at all because of how it's tended to be exercised in oppression and injustice. But you know, even if we change the name and call Jesus something else, we're not off the hook. Because we're told Jesus is the firstborn of creation, that all things are summed up in him, that everything holds together in him, that he is supreme and that he has redeemed us, bringing us into his reign of light. Sounds like a king to me. So I think we'll continue to use it. But understand as we walk through today and we sing together and hear the scriptures and pray together and come to his table, that Jesus redefines what being a king means. He reclaims it. He makes it to be what it was meant to mean. Someone said to me this week, it was a good conversation, that they really didn't understand what the lectionary was doing today. How do we get to crucifixion after we've walked this journey and then it leaves us hanging here? And then we start at the birth narratives next week. Why aren't we sort of completing the journey all the way through? Why is this going on? Why aren't we reading something from Revelation, maybe, about the fulfillment of the Lord's sovereign role at the end of time? I mean, that would make a lot of sense, right? It's a good question. And also, we're going to come back to this in a few months during Holy Week. Why is it here? How does it fit? It's like we're ending the year abruptly. I don't have all the answer to that, but I think it's very important that we are at the crucifixion, that we are at the cross, and also that we have the reading from Colossians together with that, because they each contribute an important piece of who Jesus is and what his reign is all about. It's about the nature of Jesus as king, because there's a lot to say about his reign, that he has majesty. He reigns supremely. He reigns in power, in glory. He's unique. And all that goes on, and that's important. But it's also very vital for us today to affirm that he is a king who goes to the cross. And the nature of his kingdom is found in that reality there, that he would go to the cross. And it's why we have the crucifixion today as part of understanding his reign. And so we're going to turn to the gospel passage and let the others sort of, you know, push in as they will. This is from Luke 23. And when they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there, along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." I think the first attribute or quality we see in the kingdom of Jesus is that this king is forgiving. The king is forgiving. That he offers forgiveness is Jesus living out what he taught. He's not doing something new here. He's applying what he's been teaching all along. He said the good shepherd goes after the lost sheep, the one that's run away, the one that's rebelled, the one that turns and leaves, and the good shepherd places the sheep on his shoulders and brings him back. Jesus tells this in Luke 15. In Luke 6, we hear him say that we are to love our enemies, that we're to be merciful just as the Father is merciful. And so at his place of deepest pain and isolation, he responds not with anger and retribution, as probably I would, but with forgiveness. As the ruling class sneers and his clothes are divided up, he instead declares they don't know what they're doing. He actually says that a lot. In Luke 19, as he approaches the city of Jerusalem, he says over the city, "If you'd only known." They were ignorant. They didn't recognize who he was. They didn't see him as their king and the implication of their actions, and Jesus forgives them. I think he would have forgiven them anyway. He does forgive us anyway, even when we do know what we're doing. When you're in a conflict with someone, do you assume the other person doesn't really know what they're doing? You might, if you're really kind, and you've had a lot of counseling about relationships like that. But I think we tend to claim people knew exactly what they're doing. You knew what you were doing when you did that. I mean, I think that's a, you know, we claim to that. The policeman always asks, do you know how fast you were going? I don't know why he asked that. Does it make any difference? I mean, what are you going to say? You could say, yeah, I did, actually. Or you can say, well, I wasn't really paying attention. You know, I got a lot on my mind today. I'm sure the police have heard so many different things. But I'm not sure the answer matters. You're guilty whether you knew it or not. It's your responsibility to know. Every car comes with a speedometer. Pay attention. But the king on the cross says, you didn't know. Lord, forgive them. Christ the King is a forgiving King, one who is the supreme embodiment of mercy. St. Paul says that he has rescued us from darkness, and in him we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. That's why the kingdom of God is upside down. It doesn't make sense sometimes. The King doesn't give us what we deserve. And it's actually a point that a lot of people object to. Celsus was a second century Greek philosopher, and he made this very point. He was talking about the kinds of people that other religions invite in to be a part of the religion. I mean, you want the best people, right? You want people who have influence, people who have status, people who have money, people who have a place in the world that will give that will lend stability and honor to the whatever religion that they join. But Celsus says this, but let us hear what folk these Christians call. Whosoever is a sinner, they say. Whosoever is unwise. Whosoever is a child. And in a word, whosoever is a wretch, the kingdom of God will receive him. Do you not say that a sinner is he who is dishonest, a thief, a burglar, a poisoner, a sacrilegious fellow, and a grave robber? What others would a robber invite and call? Why on earth this preference for sinners? It's because our King is a forgiving King. Secondly, the King is not out for himself. He's not out to save himself. Several times in this passage in Luke 23, voices emerge. From the crowd, from one of the criminals. that Jesus should save himself. I mean, doesn't make sense. If you're able to save yourself and you don't, does it? But this was the idea all along, that he would give up his life for others, for the sins of the whole world. He came to seek and save the lost, and his kingship is marked not by self-preservation, but by surrender and sacrifice. He took nothing by force, but he laid it all down. I think a particular strength of the kingdom of God is found here. The world measures power by what it has taken, by what it's gained, and what it's conquered. God's kingdom has power because it's given it away. It doesn't seek to grasp and to hold on to it. It's the paradox of Christian life, isn't it, that we measure spirituality sometimes in what has been surrendered rather than what's attained. This is really a puzzling part of the reign of Jesus for many. And it raises questions, and there's a lot of head scratching around it. Kings have power, right? You don't give it away, you wield it, or someone will use it against you. But Jesus reclaims the meaning of what it is to rule and to reign. This is not what his kingdom is about. In Genesis 1, this is a passage that Bishop Ken opened for us last week. At the creation, humanity is made in the image of God, and male and female, and humanity is given dominion over creation. I want you to bear with me a little bit on this. That is, we are made to rule with God in the way that God rules. We're stewards the way God is a steward. We have dominion in the way that God has dominion, according to God's manner and according to God's character. That's how, when things were pure, we were to understand rule and reign. But it's interesting, this word dominion, it actually means to have sway. It's to have influence, to lead towards in a gentle way, to mentor, to nurture. Even it has the overtones of seduction, to invite and to draw winsomely, to woo. This is the picture of dominion. But after sin entered and our relationship with God and one another was broken, we immediately see a different kind of hierarchy. In Genesis 3, as God is meeting out the curses because of sin, he tells Eve, "Your husband shall rule over you." And that's a word that's a different word than dominion. It's strong, it's harsh, it has overtones of oppression. It's not meant to be this way, is what we're hearing in it. To rule over is to know domination, not dominion. And throughout the history of kingship throughout the world, the concept of ruling has been marked by domination, even though God's plan was for something far different. God speaks through Jeremiah that he will raise up a righteous shepherd, a righteous leader in the line of King David that will nurture and care and reign wisely, doing what is just and right, tending the flock of God, not being afraid. He is a shepherd who gives his life away for the sheep, a king who surrenders power, who goes to the cross. I was struck by the refrain in the song that we sang this morning, "O Sacred King, there's kindness in your majesty." Jesus, those who recognize your power know just how wonderful you are that you draw near. See, there's a sensitivity there to the reign of Christ. He is one who does not reign for himself, and he doesn't seek to save himself. One other insight that I want to underline from this passage in Luke this morning that relates to the kingship of Jesus, I think, is that Jesus is a king who gathers and invites and unites. There are two thieves crucified with him, one on either side. One mocks him, but the other repents. He recognizes his own sin. And he asks Jesus to remember him in his kingdom. Jesus says, "Today you will be with me." See, even at the end of his earthly ministry, as his physical strength is draining away, Jesus is gathering. He's inviting to himself. He's welcoming and receiving. The unjust shepherds of Jeremiah scattered the sheep. They drove them away. The phrase that has come to my mind that I've heard kind of in my head is that they were shepherds with a troubling appetite for mutton. But not Jesus. He is the King, the Good Shepherd, who gathers and unites. He saves and redeems, calling, rescuing, making new. I was really moved this morning by Gilbert's testimony at Court 9. Just powerful. And the thing that I think that touched me, a couple of points. One is his very honest confession as a part of that. But also the sense of coming to this understanding of the God who gives himself away and who gathers and unites in love and in mercy. Not because of what we have done, but because of what he has done. Throughout the scriptures, we're told that the king will gather the nations. He will bring together. The gates of the kingdom are open. They are ready to receive, and we enter by his blood shed on the cross. And this is why we're at the crucifixion today, when we are reminded of the kingship of Jesus. So Jesus is forgiving. He is not seeking to save himself. And even at the end, he is inviting and gathering and drawing. What about us, then? We're not the king. What is it, though, to live under the reign of such a king? See, that's important because it shapes us. We're known by who we are and the allegiances that we have. If you travel internationally at all, or even go to different parts of the country, you pick up on that. Languages are different. People dress differently. The values are different. Dialects are different. This was really, when we lived in Georgia, we heard that a lot. Where are you from? And we'd say, why is it you think we're not from here? Aaron, can you explain that to me? Why people just seem to know I was a Yankee? I don't know. But we are to live in the kingdom of God in such a way as to show our citizenship. Not to hide our passport, which I've learned to do in certain places. But to speak the language, to do the works of our King. We are to reflect the one who reigns. And I think I have to ask myself, how well do I bear that image, the image of the king? Because we also are to forgive. We also are to live for others. We also are to invite and gather and unite to bring others to his kingdom. By proclaiming that Christ is king and living under his reign in a particular way, we're saying he is king over us and we are his people. We're part of the kingdom of God in the places where we live and where we work, where we go out to eat, where we have neighbors, all of that. Are we forgiving? Do we surrender ourselves for others? Am I inviting in those places in such a way that people notice and say to us, "Where did you say you were from? What kingdom are you a part of?" Thanks be to God that Jesus is our King, and he reigns in love.